Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 746.GE4120, certificate number 41602. Mad cow disease.
Right up front, I'm going to give a trigger warning. Mostly this is a trigger warning for me, because there's a lot of talk.
You can give yourself a pep talk. I don't know if you can give yourself a trigger warning.
I should have given myself a trigger warning before I dove into this. I've been meaning to talk about mad cow disease since it was on one of my earliest lists of omnibus topics. And I think it was one you and I probably looked at over the last 15 years we've been doing the show multiple times and went, nah, mad cow disease, whatever. But I decided to do a deep dive, and halfway through, I really wished I hadn't, just because...
It's a little too visceral?
I mean, yes.
In the sense of there's actually viscera?
There's viscera in this show. Not too much. I'm going to take... I don't like gross, you know? I'm not a gross-out fan.
I don't understand people who like gross. I mean, I love horror movies, but I'm not like... When somebody's like, oh, the kills and the sequel, they're so good. Let me tell you about the kills. I'm like, maybe... Maybe horror movies are the only thing keeping this guy from serial killing. I don't know.
I love like the, there's a certain line of graphic violence where I'm like, I like Game of Thrones.
The Roderick line.
But every once in a while, somebody goes over the line and their eyeballs squirt out, or they, you know, they're eviscerated, and you have to, and the camera really luxuriates in the gross. And I'm like, what is that? I don't need that. That's gross. So there's gross concepts in the mad cow disease story, and I'm not gonna dwell on them, but they are there. And if you are a vegetarian, you probably know all this.
If you like your cows sane,
yeah. If you like the idea of not feeding cows to cows, there's going to be a little bit of that.
As we all should.
Yeah,
we don't like. Nobody wants a cow nibble.
No. Did you just coin that, or is that a long? Is that an old thing? Accountable.
I'm sure I can Google it.
You know, I mentioned Kaushowitz at one point on the show, and I got a lot of people writing back saying that was not what... Ben Gibbard did not coin that phrase. That's been said about that rendering yard in Central California for a long time.
Do we really want to say Kaushowitz? It seems a little...
We don't. I prefaced it with this was a thing from the 90s.
No, we don't compare anything to the Holocaust.
No, we do not.
But I guess Art Spiegelman's, one of his memoirs is called Mauschwitz.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
But Art Spiegelman can do that, whereas.
You're saying your parents were not Holocaust survivors.
Ken Jennings and John Roderick probably don't have the same leeway.
There's no probably about it.
But there is a lot of, I was just down in the South recently. By that I mean the southern states of America.
The dirty South.
I don't mean the southern hemisphere.
Were you going around with a tape recorder trying to find old blues musicians?
It's like, hey, man. No, I was not down in the Mississippi Delta. I was on the coastal south, the southeast, they call it, I guess. The low...
I can see why.
The low country.
Yeah, low country of South Carolina.
And it really is low, South Carolina and that part of Georgia. When you fly over it, you're like, this whole area is just one big river delta.
Well, it's low because you're in a plane when you fly over.
That too, but no, you, even when you drive around, it just feels like all it takes is one big tidal surge and like three quarters of these states would just be underwater.
But think how fertile the soil would be after that.
Well, yeah, but it doesn't feel like the soil is being, like in the Netherlands, they have reclaimed all that mud mm-hmm. by putting up levees.
Yeah.
And we've done, and in New York, you know, they just keep adding to Manhattan Island. There's, and in Seattle, like a lot of Western cities, we just channeled the river. Like Los Angeles, you know, they really kept the scenic river by filling it with concrete and turning it into a slough. But we've channeled all our rivers.
It's a huge mistake, by the way, because when it was pouring rain a couple weeks ago and the LA River was actually full, you were like, boy, that could have been a very nice park if they hadn't done this to it.
Yeah, or also that's exactly all the water that you guys are missing in August. If you could have just retained it somehow.
If that had actually soaked into land
yeah.
instead of just flowing through Inglewood.
Pull up that concrete and put down some gravel. And then the fish will come back.
Come back.
The fish will come back.
To LA.
Come back, baby.
Was LA once full of fish?
Yeah, LA, famous fish. It's called the City of Angels, but the angels were fish.
They're angelfish.
Angelfish. But the low country, yeah, it just seems like they didn't, it was all built up a long time before they started to channel rivers. And it's too late now. But a lot of just
maybe with that attitude,
a lot of just muck down there.
If South Carolina wants me to come move some rivers, I'll give it a shot.
You got that power? You're the Uri Geller of rivers.
I've got some spare time.
But when I was down there, I did the thing where I went to a nice restaurant every night because even though there are 50 ramen places in Seattle, I've never visited. Because when I lived on Capitol Hill, there wasn't a single ramen place in all of Seattle.
You got decades to make up for.
But I haven't visited any of the nice restaurants in Seattle since prom, right? Since they closed the Metropolitan Grill. But when you're traveling to a different place, you're like, what are the nice restaurants? I'm going to go to all the nice places. So I did, and I made the mistake. I think now, looking back, I made the mistake of getting steak. The steak mistake.
Did you always get steak, or you made the mistake of getting steak once?
No, it's another thing that I don't have regularly, right? I don't cook steak at home very often, if at all. And when I go out to a restaurant, I typically do not go to a steakhouse. And so when you're in a fancy restaurant, it always seemed to me to be the thing that you got, right? What are you going to do? Get the fish? No, you're going to get the big steak.
They probably have really good steaks. Maybe a kind I couldn't get down at the market.
They got steaks, and so I had steaks, and I realized, I don't know what it is about me in middle age, I don't want steak anymore. Steak just feels like an awful lot of steak.
Did it give you tummy troubles?
No, it was just as I ate it, I felt like, oh God, I just got to get through this steak now. Whereas other food, it's, you feel like, oh, this is wonderful. I can't wait for another bite. This just felt like work. Like it's a big steak and it's
got to get through this
kind of rare and I'm just working at it, you know? And I realized that I had kind of outgrown steak, which seems like a weird thing, but I now feel like, yes, do get the fish. The fish is probably more interesting. Steak is kind of the same everywhere. Whereas, you know, you get some local cuisine instead, and you're probably better off.
I have to say, if I'm in the South, I'm just looking for a barbecue shack or something.
Well, for me, it's gumbo. I'll eat gumbo. I'll eat any kind of fish stew that you put up. But some of these restaurants didn't even have it. It was like, well, I don't want soft shell crab cakes.
She crab.
They call it that. She crab.
Like Hulk and She Hulk. There's crab and She crab now.
Well, I didn't even want to research it to know what it was because. You don't, if you
I know.
Put
is
the
it
word
pregnant?
She in front of a food, I'm like,
Is it full of little crab eggs?
It might be a Southernism that it doesn't even have anything to do with gender.
My rule has always been don't order steak unless you're at a steakhouse.
Right.
You know, because
just like don't order sushi if you're in the Midwest.
Exactly. But you know, at home you can grill a steak. I feel like if a restaurant's going to serve me something I'm not going to make for myself, I don't just want a piece of meat they slapped on a fire.
I have a couple of friends that on birthdays and holidays, they always send me some expensive steak in the mail.
That seems like a pretty good kind of friend to have. I know you're about to complain, but...
Well, no, I don't complain. I just put it in the freezer, and then every time I open the freezer, it's like, well, there's a $50 steak in there that I... Wagyu beef. Seems more work than I want to put in.
Last night, Mindy and I had just flown back into town yesterday, but this was like the only night... There had been an opening at a... this kind of organic, sustainable, fancy butcher shop that becomes a restaurant at night. It's like there's like six tables and a tasting menu, and it's booked up for months.
What's it called?
Should we out them on the show?
Oh, what? No, probably not. Well, depending on how the story goes.
How does the story end? I'll tell you later.
Okay.
I think anybody with Google could figure this out. It's a small restaurant at night.
But it's a butcher shop in the day.
It's a butcher shop by day. But
and then it rips the letter off its letter sweater.
Pulling the letter B. I guess you can't really turn butcher into anything that means restaurant, huh?
Butcher. Kutcher.
It turns into Ashton Kutcher. Mm. But it's a very, as you can imagine, meat-forward restaurant at night, and it's actually the kind of place that it seems like they're getting rid of maybe the parts of the cow they couldn't sell during the day. So there's like some delicious pate en croute that has some blood sausage in it, but then there's another course that's just more black pudding, this time with beef tongue. Mm-hmm. And there were five courses, and they all had meat, including dessert.
Dessert meat.
Yeah, suet pudding, I guess.
So it was all kind of offal-based?
It wasn't all awful, but... Yeah, I mean, not
all
of it.
Would you say offal or awful?
I say awful, I think.
Yeah.
The first two courses did have more...
organ meat.
Organ meats than I was expecting. But, you know, it could have been anything. It's just a tasting menu. You can't order. And it could have been sweetbreads, which I actually don't like.
Yeah.
So I feel like I dodged a bullet there. Tongue's not my favorite, but it was fine. Everything was really good, but I got done with it feeling like I had eaten a whole cow and parts that I don't usually eat.
That are rich in fat.
Too rich and fatty for me. Yeah. I just had weird dreams all night, and I still feel kind of like I don't need to eat for another week.
Weird dreams of like cows looking at you accusingly?
I don't think the beef I ate had any cultural memory of being a cow in it. It's more the kind of thing that my mad cow brain fixates on when I have like too much protein and fat in my system. And it really made me think... I don't know if I want to be a vegetarian, but I want to be like halfway a vegetarian.
Yeah. I'm just,
or maybe no beef for me anymore.
I feel more and more like not particularly for ethical reasons as much, although ethical reasons are always a nice byproduct, if you will.
I think you should, on a podcast, you should announce this for the ethical reasons.
Yeah.
And then
yeah,
later
right.
You should tell me what the real deal is.
Yeah. But I just feel like it's not as appealing, and I'm ready to try things on the menu that I wouldn't. I went to our favorite restaurant, Le Pichet, the other night.
Love Le Pichet.
And I looked at the menu and I ordered the moules.
You don't like moule frites?
Well, I had never ordered it because it always felt like, what are you going to do? Get mussels here? Like there are plenty of places to get shellfish in Seattle.
Have you eaten mussels though?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Lots.
Okay. So you don't mind, they do kind of have that earthy taste.
No, no. As I say, a fish stew is my jam. So,
right. And a fish jam is
fish jam is my stew. So out here you get a lot of different kinds of shellfish in your fish stew. And I eat them all the time, but I had never had that particular preparation of just mussels in a kind of sweet milky sauce. And it was the best. I relished them. Every bite was a new joy. And the earthiness of them and the kind of sauce, the buttery sauce. Oh,
because sometimes the taste of mussels is a bit much, but yeah, a white wine butter sauce just makes them all taste like white wine and butter.
So good.
What would you complain about?
So good. And if you have it in a cioppino or something like that, you've got that brothy taste.
Do you think this is the world's first podcast on BSE that first has half an hour about fish stews?
Yeah, maybe.
What about a bouillabaisse? Do you like a bouillabaisse?
Yes, I do. I do.
Let's talk about Houdini for half an hour before we get into...
Coming from the Northwest, right? Seafood is something that we have in abundance.
to the degree that I won't order it when I'm anywhere else.
I won't either.
Because like my favorite food is like a nice piece of salmon. But if I'm at some restaurant somewhere, I'm like, I'm not ordering salmon. I'm about to be back in Salmonville, USA.
Well, this was the thing. I was down east.
As we say.
They say. And
isn't that Maine?
Yeah, maybe. Up west, up east.
Right now we're up west.
And a lot of people were like, oh, you should try the oysters. And I said, I know what your East Coast oysters are like.
They're garbage.
They're like a big floppy tennis shoe.
You guys fly in our Puget Sound oysters because they're better.
And they were all saying, oh, no, South Carolina oysters are not like those Manhattan oysters.
That's the kind of thing where South Carolina oysters turn out to be some kind of testicle.
Yeah. I said, you are not fooling me. Where we come from, oysters are the size of a quarter, and they are crispy like a chip.
That's right. We're really confusing the future. Oysters were a famously crispy food like Pringles. They would stack in a can.
But as you know, in addition to delicious steaks and multi-purpose hamburger, a cow is a big thing. There's a lot of cow.
Yeah, I just ate some weird parts of it last night.
Yeah, I know you did. And in addition to all those weird parts that we don't typically eat, although other places in the world do, you know, some places eating all those sweetmeats and breads and tongues and stuff is really haram.
Well, Mindy and I were talking about how culturally mediated this is because, you know, nothing's better than ribs. But like, I think ribs were kind of like the garbage food that like the poor people got because everybody else just wanted the loin and the shank and the steak.
Right. And so the poor people
are like, let's make ribs delicious. And ribs are like by far the best tasting part of the pig and maybe the cow too.
They're wonderful. But all those meats that have to be cooked for a really long time and covered with sugar and salt.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all food that was thrown away. And if you think about French cooking, they use every part of the buffalo.
There's a steak place in Seattle now that has one cow a night, and basically on the wall behind you is a blackboard, and they will X out the steaks as they're eaten.
So if
you get there at 5, you can pretty much have any cut you want. By 9, you have the part of the cow that's left.
I wonder how many clever affectations can be the basis of a restaurant before they run out. Because I've eaten in restaurants where all the food, they identified it by name. This cow's name was Mary, and she lived a long and healthy life.
Every restaurant here is a Portlandia sketch.
Yeah, that's right.
It's not a...
More and more. I went to a ramen place the other day that was just straight up ramen, and they weren't trying to pretend.
Yay.
But that's probably the last one. So there's a lot of cow left over when they take all the good parts of the cow. And even when they take then the bad parts of the cow, there's still a ton of cow.
What is it that's left?
Well, so there's
bones,
pink slime, which is what we call the parts of the cow which are still meat.
And that's an industry term, right?
Yeah, pink slime.
Like the meat keeping. That's not what it's called. The butchery industry talks about.
It's known variously as boneless lean beef trimmings.
That's
or
better.
Lean finely textured beef. And what it is just it's beef, but it's the beef you can't get off the bone using industrial methods. And so they take that beef off the bone by boiling it or by otherwise, you know, cooking it and getting it off. And then it is kind of a undifferentiated slurry, which they then put into...
It becomes like filler, right?
It's filler, right. It goes into hamburgers that you get in hamburger joints, and it becomes probably 3/4 of a hot dog or whatever. Pink slime, and I've heard pink slime... In 2012, it was in the news a lot, and people were really upset about it, and it was used by all the, like, industrialized food is gross.
Seems like a branding problem.
But I talked to Kurt Timmermeister, a famous local use the whole buffalo chef. And
he's a cheesemaker, right?
He's out on
Vashon making.
He made cheese. And I think just recently he said, I'm out of the cheese game now. He was in the ice cream game for a while. But I think his last cow, whose name might have been Mary, has moved on to greener pastures, as we say. She went to live on a farm.
And she already lived on a farm.
And I don't know what Kurt's doing. I was just out there, but I never say like, what's next? Because it's always something that scares me. But I think what his next thing was like erotic photography. But anyway, enough about Kurt Timmermeister. I talked to him about Pink Slime, and he said, all this hullabaloo about Pink Slime is baloney. Pink Slime
literally.
It's literally baloney. He said, Pink Slime is great, and it's just...
That's the new hot take for Slater Twitter today. Pink Slime is great. I can't get enough.
It's just beef, and we should use it. The problem is that Pink Slime in the United States, at least, is somehow processed using ammonia.
Is that how they get it off? Or?
Yeah, must be. And so in Europe, of course, because they're so fancy over there, they have outlawed Pink Slime that is used or is made with ammonia.
Yeah, I notice when I'm in Europe, I have to order other colors of slime.
See, that's the thing.
And I hate it.
And I think ABC News said that 70% of ground beef that is sold in supermarkets contains some pink slime component.
Well, that's what I remember from these news cycles is just, are you eating pink slime? Find out. Are your children having pink slime in their lunch? Find out at 11 o'clock.
You're all eating pink slime unless you know the name of the cow that your beef came from.
Soylent Pink.
And pink slime feels like a modern invention. But really, there have been, people have been trying to use the entire cow for all of the 20th century.
For survival reasons, if nothing. I mean, it's...
But even in an industrial capacity, right? Like, for survival reasons, sure, you boil the bones, yeah. And then you burn the bones, and it becomes fertilizer. It becomes, like ash... can be used in a lot of different ways, ash from bones.
I'm going to make soap out of Bessie now.
Right. But starting in the early 20th century, the idea of creating what is called meat and bone meal and using that then as a source of protein, because if you grind up meat and bone and turn it into a meal... and by that, I don't mean a delicious meal, but like a ground
it's a
stuff.
A gooey powder of some kind.
Yeah, a food additive that you can then use that material at an industrial scale. Because, boy, there's a lot left over from a cow.
And I have no problem with like feeding my golden retriever something that says it has bone and beef meal in it.
Right. And so it gets used in pet food.
Does it go into human food? Like, is that weird brown stuff in the middle of Chef Boyardee ravioli? Is that?
Well, it doesn't now, and hopefully no, because it's, it's, yeah, right. You want it to be dog food instead of Chef Boyardee food.
There's not that big a difference. Are you saying it's not yummy?
Well, you can make anything yummy if you put enough paprika on it.
That's what I'm assuming.
But... A lot of the, I'm sorry to, this is, the trigger alerts are flying right and left here.
Stop right now.
A lot of the meat and bone meal comes from, like, for instance, if you have a bunch of cows and some of them die of natural causes, which is to say they die some way other than in the slaughterhouse. Like if a cow drops dead and you don't know why.
What if it's disease?
And you're a farmer.
What if your herd has anthrax?
Almost certainly a disease. It's some, but you don't want to just toss the cow into a bonfire. A lot of that goes into meat and bone meal.
I see. So this is like maybe suspect from a food safety point of view.
Yeah, and just like the cows that are poor grade, not food grade cows, whatever you would have those for, they go into the meat and bone meal.
Those are emotional support cows typically.
Like, yeah, emotional support cows.
Like you're on a long plane. You're not going to bring like some really nice Angus beef with you.
Well, I think a lot of it was once American Airlines said you could no longer bring a cow as an emotional support animal, a lot of these cows ended up as bone meal.
Yeah, there wasn't really an old folks home for them.
But what's interesting is that we're going to now set the Wayback Machine to the United Kingdom in the World War II era. During World War II, there were a lot of programs in the UK that were designed to try and make the island self-sufficient.
It was their finest hour.
It was, right? They would fight on the beaches. They would fight in the shops and at the roller coaster.
It's been a while since they peaked.
But they, you know, this is always a problem in war. You see it now in Ukraine, like how if you're, and you see it in Russia even, if you're blockaded, how do we manage to continue to find the transistors that are necessary to keep our airplanes in the air if we got all of our technology from the United States? And
That's an oopsie,
right? And Ukraine can't possibly make as many artillery shells as they need, and so they have to get them from their friends. In World War II, the UK needed to go back in time a little bit to a time before global trade and figure out, like, can we make enough food for ourselves? And so there were a lot of policies instituted about, like, we need more cows, and we need to have cows in a kind of sustainable sense. So much so that that the UK is, like, in the, at least as recently as the 80s, almost 40%
cows.
The United Kingdom is 40% cows. It's actually cows all the way down.
40% of the royal family, cows.
40% of the royal family is cow or cow
adjacent. Let me tell you which ones. I think you'll be surprised. Prince Edward, cow.
40% of the UK agricultural output is cow derived, either beef or beef or milk or cheese or whatnot.
I wonder how much. So, you know, I don't know how the causation or correlation works, because we think of British food as being very rich and beefy. Is that a result of having all this beef, or is the beef a result of them having
beef,
a beefy taste?
I think, well, they're called beef eaters.
Yeah, not all of them.
Well, but the beef eater ones are. even their gin is called beef eater. So beef was a big part of UK culture and still is, and a big part of UK industrial, like, food output, export output. And so, you know, the European economic community kind of got going in the 70s, and beef exports were a big part of the UK contribution to the European, you know, economic universe.
The common market.
And as part of that, they really focused on milk. How can we increase milk production? Because we make a lot of milky things. You know, big milkers are a big part of the UK scene.
Let me just Google that and see, because I want to be up to speed on this.
Yeah, whatever you do, don't Google big milkers.
Don't Google anything John says in this entry.
And so in order to increase milk production, what they realized is that cows, milking cows, needed to be fed more protein and more calcium in order to, you know, stimulate.
The more protein they get, the more milk they give.
And the, yeah, right.
And the better the milk.
And the more calcium too, right? The better, delicious milk. And so, as was the style of the time, they started adding meat and bone meal.
From cows
to cow feed.
Oh, no. Well, when was this decision made? Is this like a 40s, 50s era kind of a thing?
Yeah, this is a gradual process. You know, they were making milk and bone, or I'm sorry, meat and bone meal early in the 20th century, and it found its way into cow feed pretty early. And the ethics of feeding cows to otherwise vegetarian cows.
Yeah, was this ever discussed? But you know, the funny thing is, it's our own squeamishness. Because if they were eating chicken, you'd be like, well, yeah, it's just a meal to give them more protein. But there's something a little weird about it when it's a neighbor.
Yeah, I mean, a cow would not eat a chicken. If you watch the television show Cow and Chicken, you'll find that neither one of them have any hunger for the other. Yeah, there's no way in nature that a cow is going to eat a chicken unless you talk about it from a young one's perspective, where the chicken dies and it sows the seed and then nature grows the seed.
Yeah, I remember watching a cartoon when I was a kid where Huey, Dewey, and Louie are roasting a chicken over a spit, and I thought, well, maybe you three,
yeah,
of all species should not be eating chicken. But just because they don't eat it naturally, I mean, there's probably a lot of additives I don't eat naturally, but if we were like, we put extra potassium in Ken's food, I wouldn't be
Let's see what happens.
He never drinks a second cup of potassium at home.
Ancient Chinese secret, huh?
But the idea that, you know, you would put some extra calcium in your cow meal and it came from chicken bones, I wouldn't be like, well, I never. But suddenly when it's cow bones,
yeah, well,
I have a religious objection.
And meat and bone meal is not exclusively made of cow, although you can specify, you can get cow meat and bone meal. You can also get,
it's more.
You can get bovine and you can get, the various sort of ungulates that get turned into food. Sheep is a primary one.
Ovine.
And then you can get it all mixed together. There's actually a kind of meal that is made out of roasted chicken feathers. I mean, their industrial meat production is trying to use it all because who wants to throw it away? And
there may be an argument against industrial meat production.
As you remember from our show, Fuel from Anything.
Yeah.
What was that show called?
Everything
Into Oil.
Or something like that.
That was a whole world of trying to turn a lot of this kind of gross, awful into petroleum and gold.
It's just efficiency weirdos that want to think they've invented the perpetual motion machine.
That's right. And as you just experienced at the Deluxe Butcher Shop, blood sausage is the thing that they do in England that we never do here.
We don't like to see the word blood in our menu or cookbook.
No, but you know, there's a lot of blood in meat processing.
And I think this butcher knew this, by the way, because it was boudin noir in one dish and black pudding in the other.
Yeah,
nobody was saying, and it's full of blood.
If you get a deluxe English breakfast, sometimes it has blood sausage. The Irish do it.
Yeah, Irish breakfast for sure.
And that was always the part of it that I was like, this isn't that good. that it should be.
I mean, blood would have to be so delicious for me to be like, I'm eating a blood clot. It's shaped like a sausage, you know? And it's fine, but it just tastes like whatever they spiced it with. So you're like, oh, what if this didn't have all this blood in it?
What's crazy is that a lot of the trucks you see on the freeway are actually carrying
blood.
Well, and dead beefs, beefs parts and slurries
really
of
big,
beefs.
Big semis. They're just full of vats of slime.
Yeah, somebody posted a picture just the other day on Instagram of a semi driving through Seattle, and it was open, the top of the semi, it was like a, it looked like a semi, but there was no roof on the container, and there were all these visible beef skeletons poking out the top, and they were like, this is awful.
It was.
But there was that famous incident where one of those trucks that was carrying a slurry overturned on the...
It was here.
Overturned on the freeway, and it was on one of those sky ramps where then all the stuff kind of poured down onto the lower levels of the freeway, and they had to close the whole system. This is a terrible episode. What was I possibly thinking? I should have just made this about some kind of nuclear bomb.
A lot of people just want more pink slime mentioned in their podcast because they're enjoying a coffee, they're eating dinner.
Yeah.
They want you to that up for them.
They were eating a delicious hamburger in their car and now they're looking at that hamburger and going, please no.
It's good. This is how you make vegetarians.
That's right.
The your carbon footprint is going down by the word.
If you want to feed cows high protein meals that do not involve the ground up bones and meat of their friends.
And I do.
You can use soy and other high protein.
It's got to be more expensive.
Vegetables.
Right?
It's more expensive and then there's a lot less protein in it. This is the problem with being a vegetarian. It's really hard to get as much, or a vegan. It's hard to get as much of this material as your body craves. And it doesn't come in Gatorade. And so you've got to work a little bit harder.
My body craves pink slime.
Mm-hmm. It turns out that a lot more of this MBM, let's just start calling it MBM, although that has BM in it.
To be the problem that it has BM in it?
They fed it more to dairy cows than to beef cows.
Okay.
But it turns out the dairy cows all become beef cows.
Right. You don't want to waste any part of the dairy cow.
Yeah. So the beef cows, I guess, go into the nice steaks that you get at fancy restaurants, But the dairy cows are what end up in the hamburger. So, so that
the circle of life.
That's the circle of life. That's right. Well, let's go to the mid-1980s.
Let's not.
Where we spend a lot of our time, weirdly.
Watching MTV.
That's right. And Madonna keeps showing her midriff, and it's very unsettling to me as a young man. In the mid-80s, in the UK, there was a sudden epidemic, let's say, of cows who began to act strangely. They lost coordination.
How do you tell if a cow loses coordination? They can't do the hoof-to-nose thing.
No, but there's a certain way a cow stands. And all of a sudden, these cows had a wide stance, let's call it. And they're, you know, their heads are lolling. It seems like they have like uncontrolled movements, and they start to have what I guess you would politely say were cow psychological issues. They would startle. They got anxious. They behaved unlike
panic attacks
cows. They would have little, yeah, they had issues.
Yeah. I remember Thatcher trying to get all those kids to become cow therapists.
Yeah, that's right.
To talk them through.
Can't we just work this out? But then they started to really suffer from problems and act aggressively, which is not what you think a dairy cow, that's not how they're going
to
behave.
Well, it's not what you want if you're next to a giant animal having to poke at its secondary sexual characteristics.
Well, yeah, especially if there are tens of thousands of them.
Yeah.
You don't want them to be angry. And then cows started dying. And it turned out that when, from the time that they first manifest these symptoms to when they died, was pretty short. It was, a matter of a few months. Your cow starts standing weird. A few months later, it is dead.
I mean, that's kind of true of people.
Yeah, right. Don't
start standing weird and
don't go into your wide stance.
It's over.
Ken? I'm sorry to interrupt you.
I'll stop immediately what I was saying and listen instead to this aside.
I want to talk to you right now about Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform for building your brand and growing your business online.
Mine in particular?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
They created this whole brand just for me to grow my business online.
As far as you know, you can stand out with a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything. Your products, content you create, and even your time.
This is appealing to me as a freelancer who does not want to go back to the world of computer programming. John, what are some of the features that Squarespace could offer my new website? Should I open one up?
Let's talk for a second about custom templates.
Yes, please.
You want to start a new side hustle? You want to start your next big thing? Squarespace has best-in-class templates, and they keep adding more.
They're multiplying. Since we started this ad, there are probably 600 new Squarespace templates.
Mm-hmm. We can't confirm or deny that. But now you can just browse the category of your business, right? Like, what would you call the category of your business?
I'm a candle maker, as you know. I'm a chandler.
A chandler. Well, if you browse the category chandlery, you'll find and I'm not going to say that this is necessarily true about chandlery, but in general, you can find a perfect starting place.
I bet there's a million great Squarespace templates that match the vibe of middle-aged man selling candles online.
100%. You can customize, and I'm not going to confirm exactly 1 million, but let's say 1 million, give or take.
Plus or minus 999,000.
You can customize the templates to fit your needs, but they give you the framework that just works.
Sounds so easy.
Mm-hmm. Whatever you're making, whatever you're doing, whatever you're selling, Squarespace has all the tools you need to get your business off the ground.
Like, let's say I'm selling stuff. Will I have like a shopping cart and a checkout and a store? I don't have to program that all myself.
That's right. It's all there.
It's all built in.
It's all built right in. So here's what you need to do, Ken. You need to head to squarespace.com/omnibus.
How do you spell omnibus?
Omnibus. Omnibus.
I've been spelling it with two B's this whole time.
Omnibus. That's squarespace.com/omnibus for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, so you go, you try it out. You find your template. You load it up.
Mm-hmm.
You give it the gas.
Give it that Ken Jennings touch.
And when you're like, oh, man, I could not get better than this for three times the price anywhere else I looked, mm-hmm. then go. Use the offer code Omnibus and you'll save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Wow, 10%?
That's right.
I can't afford not to do that. Thanks, Squarespace.
So this is about at the end of 1984, early 1985, the first instances of cows in the UK kind of having these episodes. And of course, there's quite a bit of interest in what's going on. The UK government says, nothing to see here, all is well. But they realize by 1987, and they realize this by doing autopsies on the cows' brains, that they have a kind of like a spongiform encephalopathy within their brains.
Spongiform means in the shape of a sponge?
Well, yeah, it's a descriptor of what happens in the brain. They're actually...
Like pores are forming like a sponge?
Yeah, spongy holes in the brain. And what it is a long-standing occurrence that happens in mammals, and it's based around a protein called a prion.
Now, this was not known at the time, right?
Well,
prions had not been identified as a transmission of disease yet. Is that true?
Well, and the thing about a prion, it's just a protein that's broken. It's just got a little. It's folded instead of its normal proteinic shape.
Oh, so the prion guy who won the Nobel Prize for identifying them had actually discovered them a few years earlier.
Right.
Right.
And so. So this was like so they understood the process. And what happens with a prion is...
But it was a brand new thing. Like, it's not a bacteria. It's not a virus. Yeah. There's some other kind of protein that can make you sick.
And what the protein does, the bent protein, as it goes to interact with other proteins, the protein next to it also bends.
So it is like a virus.
It's not a living organism, right? Oh, it's not a virus that's trying to grow, and it's just a chemical... error.
And it's messing up the chemicals nearby.
And once the broken protein gets in there, there's no stopping it.
Hmm.
There's no vaccine. There's no, there's no cure. It's progressive, and your folded protein begets further folded proteins just because of the way that the proteins, connect or, you know, interact. And so this prion disease has been recently discovered, and now here it is affecting cows.
Are you going to talk about what the original prion disease was?
You tell me.
Well, the guy who discovered prions, as I understand it, was investigating these other kinds of brain diseases. One was called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which is basically the human brain doing the same thing.
Right.
And... he found a connection back to an earlier disease called Kuru that some New Guinean tribes would have. And it's possible there the vector was cannibalism.
Right, headhunting.
Because they were doing ritual cannibalism, and they would eat meat that had the protein or whatever, and it would literally get in their heads.
So that's the thing about the prion or prion. It's not a contagious disease. You can't get it from...
Can't breathe on somebody.
You can't even get it from milk. It requires that you eat...
You have to ingest
the affected tissue. And what they discovered rather quickly was that they were using... Here's another spoiler alert. They were using the brains and spines and nervous systems of cows in the manufacture of... meat and bone meal. So they really were trying to...
They're feeding cows cow brains.
They were. They were trying to use it all. And so the suspicion was that the initial broken prions occurred just sort of spontaneously in a certain number of animals. It's just a, it's like a mutation. It happens in human beings. It happens across all animals, and it's just a, it's a broken protein. And because it's not contagious, if it does happen to an animal, they just die.
Who cares? Yeah.
And nobody knows why, but all of a sudden it was happening to multiple cows, and it was very quickly identified as being a product of feeding cows cow nervous systems. All it took was a couple of them, or even one, to have this mutation, and all of a sudden you're spreading it throughout the industry.
And I think they already had the research about how this had been transmitted in case of human cannibalism
because of the Creutzfeldt Jakob research.
And the New Guinean Kuru guys.
And so also right away, the United States, and then it took Europe a little bit longer, but the U.S. banned the importation of British beef.
And that was huge economically.
Really big. Really big. And
that's their cash cow, if you will.
Boo. Or moo.
Yeah, how come we're not doing more moo puns?
Right. It was devastating, and it also felt like the European Union made it very difficult for Europe to ban British beef because of all the trade agreements.
Right.
But when the United States did it, it cast a very great pall on the British beef industry, and the British government responded with an awful lot of publicity and assurances that this was not actually that big of a deal. It was not. It was well under control. Don't worry about it. In 1990, the first pet cat developed feline spongiform encephalopathy
in the UK.
In the UK.
What is that? He was was there bone meal in its cat food?
He was a Siamese cat, and it turned out that actually this does cross species. The cat was eating cow brains.
Well, that means
and spinal cords in its food.
That means me eating a quarter pounder could happen.
Right. Right about 1989, they banned putting offal in cow food, but what they learned was the Creutzfeldt-Jakob or bovine encephalopathy is dormant for sometimes many years. The animal has it, but it takes a while to get going. Once it manifests, then you know the creature dies pretty quickly. But they'd been feeding MBM to animals, you know, since the post-war period, at least. It's kind of unclear when exactly it started to migrate into the food chain in this way. You know, there wasn't an inspector with a clipboard going, all right, open the chute and start putting those brain pellets here.
What that means is it could show up years later.
Right. And the idea that that it was transmissible by eating the cows that had it, at first, what the government did was say, any cow that seems loco, we're not going to feed you. How about that? What if we just take out the cows that are loco or standing funny?
But I assume there are cows that have prions in their brains that are not yet standing funny.
Lots and lots of cows that had that. But the government's trying to, the British government is trying to mitigate this disaster.
Yeah.
In 1990, what was essentially the head of the UK Ministry of Agriculture, a man by the name of John Gummer, who is even now in the House of Lords, he went on television and fed his 4-year-old daughter a burger on TV. Like, look, it's safe. I'm even going to give my daughter a burger. And she, this little girl, was like, I'll eat a burger, whatever. I ate a burger on TV. It was only later that they
she got BSE.
Yeah, well, they realized like, oh, that was probably not a good idea. There were some zoo animals that contracted it, including a lion.
Really?
And by 1992, there were over 100,000 confirmed cases of BSE in British cows. And in order to then, you know, they kind of had to acknowledge at that point that this was a drag. And over the course of the next few years, the British government slaughtered over 4 million cows and disposed of them and took them out of the food chain entirely.
Do you know what the criteria was? This was everybody symptomatic, or was it just everybody on a farm with anybody who was symptomatic? Yeah. Or was it like it wasn't every cow in Britain, right?
Well, they started killing cows, and in fact, they started killing cows before they could actually do the tests on the cows to see if they had been exposed to BSE.
Oh.
There are about 10 million cows in Britain now, and they killed, 4.5 million in the 80s.
Every other cow.
So it really was a lot of cows, and I think there were some cows that had not been fed this stuff. Kurt Timmermeister's cows hadn't. I mean, there would have been cows that would have not been exposed to MBM.
Only the organic artisanal cows are left.
But there were a lot of cows just proactively murdered. And eventually over...
And the meat couldn't be used.
Couldn't be used. Ultimately, over 180,000 cows developed signs of, or were afflicted with BSE.
And the American terror was that this was coming. This was surely coming.
Well, it was coming, and also that any American who had lived for more than 6 months in England starting in 1980 until the mid-90s, if you had spent more than 6 months in the UK during that period, you were potentially at risk of developing Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease.
As recently as 2 years ago, I could not give blood.
Yeah, that's right.
And because I'd lived in Europe in the 90s.
That was true for a lot of people. And I was in Europe a couple of times during that period. And both times...
You got mad cow.
But both times I got mad cow. But the second time cured the first time. It was like reverse mad cow.
Homeopathic mad cow. Yeah, they should have just tried to put a little bit of bone meal, like a microscopic bit of bone meal in the feed to see if homeopathy cures mad
cow.
Just
to see it. That's right. But both times I was in Europe for over 6 months, and so I also haven't been able to give blood until very, as you point out, very recently.
Yeah, they changed it, I think, 3 years ago, and I didn't even know.
Yeah.
Because I was always like, oh, I can't go to the blood drive, sorry. I wasn't that sorry, because it's not that much fun to give blood.
But it's great to give blood.
Well, it's good for the...
Congratulations.
It makes you a good person.
It does.
But I liked that I didn't have to actually get a needle in me to feel like a good person.
Yeah.
But now I do again.
Well, they've recently, there were restrictions. If you were gay, you couldn't give blood.
And those restrictions are still actually kind of enforced.
Some, although they are starting to loosen up. As of 2021 in the UK, if you're in a long-term relationship, long-term homosexual relationship, you can now give blood again. If you're having...
That's what I should have done to cancel out the mad cow thing. Now, I lived in Europe, but I'm willing to get into a long-term gay relationship if it means I can once again give blood.
At the time, it wouldn't have helped you.
Oh, that's true.
It was only in 1994 that the connection between bovine spongiform encephalopathy was directly connected to instances of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in human beings. Which is also an encephalopathy.
And did that ever become like an epidemic or was it just like a handful of people and then it never, because you can't be contagious for it.
Well, it definitely sparked a panic.
If your mom has Creutzfeldt-Jakob, obviously you don't want to
eat her brain.
Stew and eat her.
Right.
But I guess, can it be transmitted through breastfeeding, for example?
No, but it can be transmitted through blood transfusion.
Ah, blood transfusion.
Right. So anyone who ate beef during that period in the UK, because, you know, it's possible that the United States did not actually import that much British beef, enough that it was a public health hazard, although Canada did. And, you know, one of the very few instances of someone, maybe the only instance of someone in the United States actually dying from it, was from a Canadian who had emigrated to the U.S.
Once again, they're not sending their best, Canada.
In 1995, the first person died of Creutzfeldt Jakob disease.
In the UK, or I mean in Europe
somewhere? In the UK, a man by the name of Stephen Churchill, no relation. And he was only 19 years old. Now, usually Creutzfeldt Jakob appears in people in the
elderly.
Yeah, at later age. So for somebody to be 19 years old and die of this was startling and terrifying.
And clear that it was a new beef-related problem.
Yeah, right? the connection was made. And at that point in time, it wasn't until 1996 that the United Kingdom finally admitted that CJD was caused by BSE, by ingestion of the BSE. At which point the EU finally had justification to ban British beef.
So in 96, they lost their biggest market, basically.
Yeah.
After already losing half their cows.
Now, throughout the entire era, all of the 80s and 90s and 2000s, only 100 and when I say only, I recognize that even one person dying of ingesting cows that had ingested cows was too many.
What if it's Hitler?
But if Hitler died of it,
I'm going to go back in time and feed Hitler British beef.
That would be like a subplot of a not very good Quentin Tarantino movie. 178 people died of Creutzfeldt Jakob in the UK, and another 50 people worldwide. And then I think that number now has gone up to about 188 people. Like, it's still every once in a while somebody gets it, and it can be kind of traced to
their
British beef,
their roast beef Sunday supper with Yorkshire pud.
It's
interesting because I kind of think of this as a nothing burger, literally. Like, oh, this was the scare that never happened, like bird flu or SARS or whatever. But no, like a couple hundred people got a dread brain eating disease.
Yeah. And it was not clear. I mean, I think the ban on blood transfusions actually worked to stop the spread of the disease that way. Although, I think there were four people who died from getting transfusions.
Hmm.
When they banned blood donors who had lived in the UK for more than 6 months, it actually represented over 2% of all the blood donated in the United States, which is, you know, like, what percentage of Americans have passports?
Yeah.
Not all of us.
It's been under half, I think, for...
But, you know, there's always a limit, or there's always a need for more blood donation. And so even that 2%...
We had to throw away a ton of...
Yeah.
I mean, 2% blood is good, though, because it's lower fat than whole blood. So what happened to all those farmers that lost half their herds? Was there any kind of big bailout, or?
Yeah, the British government came in with subsidies. The British people kind of changed their shopping and eating habits during that period. I think it also happened in Europe that people were less interested in en bourgeois or from a bourgeois and went back to eating rabbits and snails or whatever it was they originally subsisted on.
Yeah. Rabbits and snails.
Now, some of the suspicion was that sheep actually have a disease called scrapie.
Yeah.
Which is a similar spongiform disease.
Is it prion mediated?
Yeah. Or? It's fairly common in sheep herds. And all attempts to eliminate it in sheep, both in the UK and in Canada, kind of fail because it seems like even if you cull all the sheep in a certain herd, you reintroduce a herd into that same pasture and it will reoccur.
Yeah.
Some suspicion that it actually is in the urine and the
what you're eating grass that's been peed on?
Yeah, the prions can sit there in the grass waiting for the sheep to come along and eat the grass.
The prions that you pee on.
So boy, I wish I had a bell for that. That was pretty nice.
You should have like a cowbell for this.
I like your puns that rhyme.
You've really mellowed a lot.
Yeah. I don't know. It's like pissing up a rope. And so some of the, you know, including sheep in the MBM was curtailed. The government subsidized the farmers, but it ended up costing probably £1 billion to the, you know, UK economy.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, there was a lot of hand-wringing about how it was going to, you know, there were going to be enormous job losses and economic consequences that kind of didn't. A lot of the damage to the economy actually came from sort of bolstering the industry in the aftermath. Over time, the UK beef industry has recovered. There were in 2006, the UK finally lifted the ban on imports of beef. And there were only a few years before Brexit then probably affected the industry
much more. Worse than prions.
After the EU lifted the ban, France continued to maintain a ban on British beef, even though it was illegal in the EU. The French were, you know, very French about it.
Yeah, that seems like it's dating back centuries there.
Yeah.
Like, they were enjoying doing that.
Over 350,000 tons of this meal is generated every year in the UK still.
But now they can't give it to cows?
They don't give it to cows. Or rather, there are limits on the kind of meal they can give to cows. There's all this kind of fudgy...
Is it like how many rat hairs you can have in your Baby Ruth?
What it is is cows that are young, they can still, you know, if the cow is under 30 months old when they kill it, they can still use that stuff in meal that they feed to cows.
Because there was never any evidence of prions in a cow that young or something?
Yeah, I guess not.
Hmm.
They still use this meal in a lot of different, sort of situations where protein was necessary. They do use it as fertilizer because it's high in phosphorus and calcium and nitrogen.
But British bodybuilders aren't slamming it at the gym.
Well, what the research determined was that only people with a certain gene were liable to get.
Oh, interesting.
Creutzfeldt-Jakob. It's something
it's
called
got the, it's overlap the, with your chromosomes.
Yeah, it's the M form of the PRNP gene. If you have the M form, you are more susceptible, or those were the people that came down with it. Apparently, there's another gene, the V form of that gene, where people are infected with it but have been asymptomatic for decades.
Don't eat them.
Please don't eat those people.
Well, that's interesting because you could get tested. You get 23andMe'd for this CJD-proof gene, and then you could just go to Sainsbury's or Tesco and buy the cheaper beef. Like, they could have two kinds of beef. Like, this might have mad cow. So if you have the whatever gene, maybe get the nicer stuff.
It turns out that that of the six cases in the U.S., five of those were people that had what's called atypical Creutzfeldt-Jakob, which means that classical BSE is the one that is...
OGBSE.
OGBSE is the one that is transmitted from cows that have eaten cows.
Mm-hmm.
atypical is the version of it that is spontaneous.
Mystery.
That just your prions are bent.
Mutated.
And of the six people in the U.S. that had it, five of them had atypical. So spontaneously generated, not from British beef.
So protectionism worked.
That's right.
Keep out the British beef.
And the one person that did have it, as I mentioned, was Canadian.
I'm looking at a 1998 article about some testimony that was given about a scientist saying that he saw this coming in 89, and if he just had the government data, the whole thing could have been stopped. But that happens with every tragic thing.
Yeah, big government cover-up.
There's always one bureaucrat in office somewhere who's like, I could have solved this, but eight other bureaucrats wouldn't let me see their files. It also has a list of what the economic impacts were to various English industries, and I'm sorry to say that the losers included specialist exporters of bull semen.
Oh, bull semen.
When will someone speak up for the bull semen exporters?
Wow.
Because you don't want, you know, if there's prions, sure. Prion proteins in your bull's head, you're not going to risk
it in the semen.
Yeah, you're not going to resist putting that in your
Well,
in
what
your
about all
cows?
The French people that loved a big glass of bull semen?
Right. What do you think they switched to of a weekend? It must have changed their whole culture.
What's interesting is that there's a new application of meat and bone meal.
Yes,
which
yes.
is as a...
that's what Legos are made of now.
No, it's an alternative fuel source.
Oh, wow.
They are burning blood and bone meal pellets in these alternative fuel incinerators and generating power from them.
But did they really? That doesn't seem super green.
Well, it's greener. The only problem is if it's processed with ammonia and cyanide, that stuff is bad when it gets into the smoke.
What if there's prions in the smoke?
Well, apparently
you can't breathe in BSE.
No, apparently if you put, other than eating the peed on grass, if you use this as fertilizer, the prions don't appear to then make it all the way to
the parsnips,
to your corn. Yeah. And if you burn it for fuel, it seems like, I mean, it's an efficient, a power source. It doesn't pollute as much as well, not as much as coal or natural gas.
I guess there's probably ways to sequester the carbon.
Cause it burns, they burn all of the buffalo.
And that concludes Mad Cow Disease, entry 746.GE4120, certificate number 41602, in the omnibus. Futurelings, we can only warn you of the great curse of our era. Please learn from our mistake. Do not go on social media and seek out at Ken Jennings or at John Roderick.
Or Big Milkers.
Don't go to John's other Twitter account for Big Milkers. You can email us, or you could in our era, at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You could send us physical mail to P.O. Box 44. That's not right. To P.O. Box 55744. Does that sound like
yep,
it?
That's right.
I can do it if I don't think about it. Shoreline, Washington, 98155. A ton of postcards here.
All right. Read them off. Since my show is significantly shorter than your last show, we've got all the time in the world.
Should we do 20 more minutes of this so we can beat the Amazing Randy record? The Getty family has sent us Valentine's cards. You know, it's been so long since I got the mail. We have Christmas cards and Valentine's cards.
What, you mean
here.
The Getty family?
Yeah, that's
Why
right.
Why didn't they send us
a check? Should we kidnap this baby? Should we send them like its ear or a little toe
cute
or something?
Baby and its little sunglasses.
Adorable. The Getty's baby is going to be our Valentine. He was listening to the podcast since he was in the womb, and his favorite episode is the Christmas pickle. I don't know if that's in utero or not.
I met a young child when I was in Charleston. I think a little boy who was about 3 years old, and his parents said that he had been listening to Omnibus since he was born.
Weird.
And so I sat there and talked to him, and he was extremely suspicious of me, gave me the gas face the entire time.
He's more of a Ken fan.
Yeah, and I was like, hey, you listen to me all the time. Like, I'm the guy from the radio. And he was just like, nope. And he just noped me the whole time right until the end.
I know when I was a kid, I never thought people sounded like their radio voices. You know, like I thought all people on the radio sounded the same, but if you ever happened to, you know, hear them in person somehow, they would just sound like normals.
Yeah. Well, maybe he didn't like me for other reasons. Maybe he really liked me and that was just how he showed affection.
Jonathan wants us to know that. Oh, by the way, this Getty baby is going to be our omnibus intern in 18 years.
Nice.
And James was actually in his mom's belly when she ran the Boston Marathon.
Whoa.
So he's completed the Boston Marathon.
What a stud.
And he's not even 1 year old yet. Jonathan wants us to know that he studied cursive in school and Catholic school and still uses it all the time. Thank you, Jonathan from Utica.
Mm-hmm.
It's a postcard of Notre Dame, but it appears to not be French. It says, Vagante tra Pariso, Notre Dame Cathedralo, Cai Libro Brocantistoi, Se la Caioi.
Is it Portuguese?
He invites us to guess what the language is.
Show it to me.
It's got a lot of words ending with O-J. I think it's Slavic. I don't think it's Esperanto, because with a C, there's a C with a little carrot on it.
That does seem...
You would not put that in your created language, right?
No, what is that? Czech?
It's definitely... Yeah, I was going to go Czech or Polish. Czech, maybe?
Well, I don't know. It's not Turkish. Cathedralo.
I think it's...
Is their name for cathedral, so...
But I don't think it's Romanian. Like, I don't think it's...
No, Romanian, it's not language. Romanian, because it would have more oshes at the end. Who says cathedralo?
I'm going to put that K-A-J-O-G book into Google Translate and let it auto tell me what it... Oh, maybe it is Esperanto.
Really?
That's funny. I looked like Esperanto except for having a C with a little doohickey on it.
I think it might be Serbian.
K-A-J-O-G means platforms.
I'm gonna say Serbo-Croatian.
Ooh.
But I don't know, but I'm not confident about that. Well, anyway.
We may never know.
Well done,
in Serbian,
Jonathan.
K-A-J-O-G means sorry. But would you really put that in your postcard thing?
Well, I think with the O at the end, it means cathedral, but I don't know.
Heather sent us a postcard from Antarctica. We've never had one before.
Look at that. That's a nice boat. Is that the one that you were on when you went?
Yeah, this is much nicer than my boat. She took the National Geographic Lindblad expedition because that's the one that always advertised on Jeopardy.
Oh,
it would be
cool.
Like, Alex Trebek will be going to the Galapagos with Lindblad expeditions. So, and she actually used this because of its Jeopardy affiliation. So product placement works.
Does Jeopardy get a cut?
Yeah, we have some kind of deal with them, I think. Somebody named, I was going to keep the envelope because all the card says is, I love you, M.
Hmm.
And it's a little card where you're supposed to find 23 hidden hearts. Oh, it's a Valentine's Day card. 23 hearts, a B, a spoof. Oh, didn't this person send us these before? I think this correspondent sent us one of her Valentine cards before, right?
Yeah.
This rings a bell. Chris notes that you mentioned recently that your daughter likes stickers.
Yes.
And so he would like her to have these very confusing ones, including, let's see, Grace Kelly with a Geordie LaForge eye visor.
Okay, that's weird. She'll love that, though.
Colonel Sanders, like in a Chairman Mao type situation.
She won't understand that at all.
I don't know. The Star Wars bounty hunter, maybe? A picture.
She likes that, I bet.
Peppy Lives with a low-res picture of some kind of Pokemon walrus. I don't understand any of these.
Sure she'll like that.
I don't understand any of these references, but... She'll like when I was a kid, I just wanted free stickers. I didn't care what was on them.
Yeah, right. But I mean, I think that she has a natural suspicion of old guys with white mustaches now. So she's like, I don't want a poster that looks like you.
Correctly. Our friend Sparky sent us this from Savannah. This is, you guys might have been there at the same time. Sparky, as you know, is a truck driver who sees much of America. And he writes, I'm not quite certain how Ken got the notion that I'm a truck driver. Should I disabuse him of this?
We did.
Could I? I've run out of space on this postcard. Oh, Sparky.
We did at length talk about our listeners that are truck drivers.
Sparky is claiming not to be one of them, and I have no idea why I thought he was.
Right.
And finally, Owen sent us a belated Christmas card with a holiday gift. Oh, well, he wanted me to sign a sports card, which I didn't send back to him, a trading card. It's actually one that comes with a swatch of a suit I wore on Jeopardy. Did you know they do that?
Huh?
It makes sense for athletes where it'll, the card will come with a little bit of cloth from their uniform.
What?
Like a game relic.
So they take
and
some
it cures disease.
Some suit of yours and chop it up into little pieces?
Yeah, the Tops or whoever the card company was, it wasn't Upper Deck, I don't know, was like, hey, can you donate something you wore on Jeopardy? And I sent them a pair of slacks that maybe I did. I really don't know.
Gross.
And they've been lying to America and saying that it's...
They're pieces of the True Cross.
It's certainly slacks I wore. Did I wear them on TV? There's no way to know. But the main thing that Owen has blessed us with is baseball cards from the Seattle Pilots. In what was their one and only season, I think? Is that true? Didn't they move to Milwaukee right after that first year?
So there was a Triple A baseball team in Anchorage called the Anchorage Glacier Pilots.
No.
But I think that's a different group.
The 1969 Seattle, they played at Sick Stadium, which is now where that Lowe's
where the Rainiers played for years and years. Rainiers.
Well, this was our first major league team, but then they immediately decamped for Milwaukee.
Boo.
But not before they could print these cards of favorites like Diego Sigui, Danny Walton, Marty Patton, John Kennedy. Wow, who knew? Survived Dallas and went on to pitch. What does he play?
Well,
shortstop. Play shortstop for the Pilots.
So I'm guessing.
And Steve Hovley.
We've either talked about this and I was not paying attention, or this has never come up, but you seem like a baseball card collector.
I'm actually not.
Really?
But I'm delighted to have these. Did you know Topps Cards of this era had a little Bazooka Joe-style cartoon in the upper right?
No, I did not.
With some kind of Ripley's Believe It or Not fan about the fact about the... So pitcher Diego Sigui has a picture of him... it says, Diego uses a baffling forkball, and we see a baseball player...
You're a baffling forkball.
Your mom's a baffling forkball. You see this pitcher who's mystified. He's holding a ball with a fork sticking out of it.
Let me see it. So each cartoon actually relates to the player?
Yeah, they all have like a goofy little junior jumble in the upper right. I've never seen a Topps card of this
era.
That
looks like a sex thing. Dan was a top wrestler in high school.
I hope he found a bottom wrestler.
He's crouched over an umpire in a weird way. So these don't... Oh, look at them. They're so gorgeous.
I know, right?
But these don't... what about your son? He seems like a... I'm sorry, what about your older son?
He's got a room full of...
This type of memorabilia?
Yeah. And nothing collectible, I think.
If you pay your bills, you pay your memorabilia.
They're not they're not in great condition, but, you know, he loves having weird old... The ushers at...
Couple
at
of these
T-Mobile,
are dupes.
Yeah, we can each have one. The ushers at T-Mobile would give out old, not collectible baseball cards to kids, and both my kids thought that was fantastic.
And now it turns out they're worth $1 million.
No.
Well, those are cool, and you know,
thank you, Owen.
I know people that really care about sports, and maybe I don't know. I'll never actually get those to them, but
Owen. You can also. You don't have to send us baseball cards. We'll love you anyway. You could hang out with your fellow futurelings online on Facebook or elsewhere. You could serve the show by writing a nice Apple Podcast review of it or recommending it to a friend or making your baby listen to it in utero during a marathon. But the best way to support the show, the most direct way, is to go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and become one of our devoted army of supporters. That's what keeps the show going. We're grateful to all those who support Omnibus.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all the recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese, and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.